for Leologos Radio, the weekly radio program featuring the best in Greek music and culture, plus interviews with Greek and international newsmakers. Leologos Radio with Michael Nevaralekis begins now.
Κυνηγημένο μου πουλί, ritorni. Se dire che potevi dire sì, se sarà te la
torni. That was Dimitra Galani and Kostadinos Vita with a new remake of the classic Greek song Imerakini de Thargisi, starting us off today. This is the Dialogos Radio, the weekly Greek radio program which airs worldwide on 20 radio stations across 5 countries, 4 continents, and online. My name is Michael Nevradakis, and today on our program, we will feature, as part of the Dialogos interview series, an interview with well-known economist Warren Mosler, who is a leading figure in the field of modern monetary theory, and who was the co-founder of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Mosler will speak to us today about money, debt, the Eurozone, and everything that has been happening there, about the Greek economic crisis, and about his two solutions for Greece and for Europe to emerge out of the current so-called crisis. This interview will be followed up by some great Greek music and by our commentary of the week. Coming up now, though, is the Dialogos interview series and our interview with economist Warren Mosler right here on Dialogos Radio.
Η συνέντευξη της εβδομάδας. Κάθε εβδομάδα εδώ στο Dialogos Radio παρουσιάζουμε συνεντεύξεις για θέματα που αφορούν την επικαιρότητα, την οικονομία, τον πολιτισμό και τον απανταχού ελληνισμό. Ακολουθεί τώρα εδώ στο Dialogos Radio.
Joining us today on Dialogos Radio in the Dialogos interview series is economist Warren Mosler, co-founder of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and a leader in the field of modern monetary theory. He will speak to us today about money, debt, Greece, the Eurozone, and much more. Warren, thank you for joining us today.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Let's begin with a question that might seem obvious and yet is something that so few people actually understand. What is money and how is it actually created?
Okay. Well, you know, if you talk to different economists, they'll give you different definitions of, you know, what money is. So I actually don't even use the word. What our currencies are, such as the euro, the dollar, the yen, those are just the thing needed to pay taxes. They're tax credits. And they're no different than a tax credit you might get for solar energy, where the U.S. government might give you $1 million tax credit. That's no different than getting $1 million. And so the currencies we generally talk about are basically just tax credits.
Another topic that is often misunderstood, and it relates to this first question, is the role of the central banks, such as the ECB and the Federal Reserve. What are they? Who operates them? How do they operate? And do they actually create money or tax credits?
They are like the scorekeeper for the currency, and they are the government's what they call fiscal agent. They have a spreadsheet, just like you would set up a spreadsheet on your computer, and they put debits in, they open up accounts for the member banks, their own member banks, and for foreign governments and for a few others. And when the government spends, they put credit into the appropriate account. When it taxes, they debit the appropriate account. And they also generally regulate and supervise the banking system to some degree. So those are the two roles they generally have. And as part of the operator of the spreadsheet, the scorekeeper, so to speak, they've also given the job of determining what's the appropriate interest rate. Because with floating exchange rates, there's no such thing as a market determining rates. It's the government has to set some rate or the rate will just sit there at zero. So in a floating exchange rate, the natural rate of interest, the rate without government intervention is zero. And then it's up to the government to, if it wants to support a higher rate, to take some kind of action to do that. And that comes in the form of either paying interest on balances at the central bank, interest on reserves, or selling treasury securities, which are just interest-bearing accounts at the central bank.
Now, having discussed this, what then is public debt?
What we call the public debt are, for example, in the U.S., are the dollars spent by the government that haven't yet been used to pay taxes. And when the government spends these dollars, they credit bank accounts, they get into various bank accounts. And when they sell treasury securities, which is called borrowing, dollars shift from one type of bank account to another type of bank account called the government bond. The government bond is just a bank account at the Federal Reserve Bank. They call it securities accounts. It's just like a savings account at a normal bank. And the same is true in the Eurozone. All the government government debt in the Eurozone are nothing more than savings accounts in the central bank system. You give them euro, you get them back with interest. With negative rates, you got to pay a little interest, but it's the same as a savings account. And that's true in Japan, in the UK, any country that has their own currency and issues bonds. The public debt is just the money the government has spent. It hasn't yet been used to pay taxes, and it sits in what are best thought of as either checking accounts or savings accounts at the central bank, or some of it might sit in cash, and that's the public debt.
Having brought up the Eurozone, let's look at the situation in Greece. Is the economic crisis in Greece a debt crisis, as it's often described?
Well, it is under the current context of the rules and regulations set down. A debt crisis is a crisis. It's a political choice to have a debt crisis. If the central bank, the ECB, guarantees the debt, there's no debt crisis. If they don't guarantee the debt, there is a debt crisis. And so before the debt was guaranteed in 2012, that was before Mario Draghi said, we will do what it takes to prevent default. And saying there's no default is saying the debt is guaranteed. Before that, all the countries were about to come apart because of a debt crisis. But once the central bank guaranteed all the debt, then the idea of a debt crisis immediately goes away. Interest rates come down. And what they did was they said, okay, well, there's a guarantee, so there's no debt crisis, but it's conditional. There's conditionality here. It's conditional to you have to obey the rules. You have to obey the fiscal rules of the European Union. And if you try to violate the fiscal rules, then you're no longer under the umbrella of the central bank guarantee. And so when Greece tried to, there was some risk that Greece would step out of the fiscal compliance, then there was risk that their debt would not be guaranteed and suddenly interest rates shoot up and suddenly they can't finance themselves and suddenly you have a debt crisis. So yes, there is one potential debt crisis, but it's a political decision. It's not a market situation. It's not something that happens outside of political control.
You mentioned the fiscal rules that are enforced in a European Union, and one set of rules has to do with the deficit levels that EU member states can maintain. You have argued that these deficit limits are the cause of the continent-wide crisis. Why do you believe that this is the case, and what is the solution that you have proposed for countries like Greece with regards to the deficit limits?
Well, there's a theory of macroeconomics out there that says governments should balance their budgets, and then the central bank can use interest rates to control the economy. So you balance your budget, and then if the economy is bad, like it is today, they lower interest rates, and that causes the economy to do better, and everything's fine. Everybody has a balanced budget, and interest rates are at the appropriate level. So interest rates are like the thermostat on the wall. It gets too cold, you use interest rates to warm things up, and if it gets too hot, you use interest rates to cool things down. And as a follow-up to that, they have quantitative easing, which is just a derivative of interest rate policy. It's basically the same thing. What's happened is Japan's tried that for 20 years, and it hasn't worked yet. And the Federal Reserve's been doing it for 7 years and still fighting deflation. Japan's had deflation. It's been fighting deflation for 20 years. And the European Union now for about 6 years. And if you ask any one of them, they say, well, it's just going to take a little bit more time. Okay, so there's one theory that says you just balance your budgets and it's just going to take more time. You just wait. And then to me, the reality is this whole idea that using interest rates to control the economy, it just doesn't work. And so we need to recognize that fact. And I can give you a couple of reasons why I think it doesn't work. And one of them is that governments are net payers of interest to the economy. Governments pay a lot of euro to bondholders in the European Union. And that's income for the economy, and income is good for the economy. That's money to spend. There I go using the word money. Okay, that's it. You know, I'll use it casually. And so when Mario Draghi said, we'll do what it takes to prevent default, interest rates came down. Now, that was good for the cosmetics of all the member nations, all their interest rates came down. But that means they pay less interest to the economy. People are earning less interest on their bonds. I'm an Italian bond now. You earn less than 2%, where you were earning over 7% before on all the new bonds. And so how does cutting back on interest income paid to the economy help the economy? You know, what is the economy? The economy is just spending. GDP is total spending in the economy. It's sales. And if a strong economy means there's strong sales, and a weak economy means there's weak sales. And so cutting back on income, reducing interest income, reducing rates, reduces interest income to the economy. Now, when the central bank buys bonds, now the central bank holds, that's called quantitative easing, now the central bank holds those bonds, those savings accounts, instead of somebody in the economy, some entity in the economy. And so the central bank's earning the interest instead of the economy. And the central bank started showing large profits that all that interest would have been earned by the economy. And what does the central bank do with the money? Well, they turn it back to the government, so to speak, but they don't spend it. Okay, they just use it to reduce their debt. And so, it's a drain on income. What they call monetary policy in first instance drains a substantial amount of income from the real economy. And to me, that gives you your first clue as to why this policy doesn't work to make the economy better. Okay, the other idea, which goes back 300 years in economics, it's nothing new that I'm going to tell you here. The best way to think about it is, what if everybody decided not to spend anything, any of their income, they just stopped spending any money at all? What would happen to the economy? Well, the answer is it goes to zero. There'd be nothing sold, so there'd be no jobs, no income, you know, no economy. It would be a disaster. So the economy is dependent on people spending their income. And what follows from that is, for anyone who spends less than their income, someone else has to spend more than their income to make up for it, or sales don't hold up. The output doesn't get sold, and you have unemployment, and you've got serious economic problems. A large part of the economy that naturally spends less than their income. People get paid, money goes into a pension fund or a contribution, or it gets withheld for one thing or another. They don't get all their income to spend. And they don't spend it all anyway. They keep a little bit in cash. And then you've got corporations that build reserves, and they don't spend their income. Insurance companies take in premiums, and they don't spend all their income. They save some for later. And all the cash in circulation is income that hasn't been spent yet. Somebody's sitting. And then you have foreign central banks that will hold euros and savings. That's income that hasn't been spent yet. And so you've got all these savings desires, all these entities that try to save euro and spend less than their income. Well, something has to make up for that, or else you get a bad economy. And if you look at the first 7 or 8 years of the euro, the private sector credit expansion was the source. That's where everyone was spending more than their income. They were borrowing for houses. Spain had a big housing boom. They're borrowing for cars. Their business was borrowing to expand. Okay, and so you had all these entities in the private sector spending more than their income to make up for all the entities that were spending less than their income. And it was sort of okay. Unemployment was down from 8% to 7%. There wasn't any blood in the streets. People were sort of happy with it. Well, then the crisis hit in 2008, the credit crisis, and suddenly the people who were spending more than their income couldn't do that anymore, and credit growth just stopped. And so now there was no one to make up for all the entities, all the people spending less than their income. There was nobody out there spending more than their income. And so the economy stalled out, and unemployment went straight up. Now, governments could very easily make an adjustment to spend more than their income. They could lower taxes, or they could increase public spending, public services, and then the government could make up for the lost spending, make up for people's savings, spend more than their income, and fill that gap. And by cutting taxes, they could allow private sector to have more income, to have more spending, and again, fill up the gap. So depending on your politics, you can either reduce taxes or you can increase public spending. I'm not trying to take sides on the left-right debate here about which is better. But governments can't do that in the European, because they're limited by 3% deficits. And that's not enough, given the lack of private sector credit and the natural desire to save. Europeans are very good savers. It's not enough to make up for the people not spending their income. So all this income goes unspent, and the economy suffers.
We are speaking with economist Warren Mosler here on the Alagos Radio and the Alagos Interview Series. And Warren, from what I understand, you proposed as one solution for the European Union, the loosening of these deficit limits to actually allow countries to run larger deficits.
So they don't want to do that because they think we just have to wait longer for interest rates to work. And what I'm saying is, look, let's just use the deficit limit as the thermostat on the wall to control the economy. So it's ice cold right now. So reduce the limit from 3% to maybe 8%. Now, with the central bank guarantee in place, you don't have to worry about markets. Interest rates are going to stay at the ECB policy rate. So the markets have nothing to say about this. So you increase the deficit limit from, let's say, 3% to 8%, that you just add 5%, and that'll add approximately 3%, 4%, 5% to GDP. Economists might disagree in that, but they'll all agree it'll add a lot. And then each member can decide to either reduce taxes or increase public spending. They can have a big debate about how to get to the new limit if they want to. If they don't want to, they can stay where they are, but they have the option to increase the deficit limit. And unemployment will, every forecaster will immediately drop this unemployment forecast from wherever it is now, somewhere around 11 to probably 9, maybe even less. And so unemployment will come down pretty dramatically by full points, and GDP will go up to from near zero to maybe 3%, 4%, or 5%. And the European Union will be deemed a big success, and there'll be, you know, big parties in the streets, and the crisis is over. It's not hard, and there's no economist who would not have that in his forecast if that were to happen. But the policymakers don't think it's necessary. They believe we just have to wait more time for these interest rates to kick in, and they're willing to do that. And they've been waiting, again, 20 years in Japan, 7 years in the U.S., and 6 years in the European Union. What I'm saying is, like, make the fiscal adjustment. If the interest rates do kick in like you think, just reverse the fiscal adjustments. If the economy starts getting too hot and unemployment drops too far and everybody's worried about inflation, then go back to 3%. You know, you don't have to stay there forever if things heat up too much for you. I don't think they will, but you know, should that happen, it's just as easy to go back in the other direction. But, you know, I'm just one person here saying this. That's my proposal.
Now, what is the real debt solution for Greece as you have proposed it? Does it involve Greece paying off its debt, or perhaps does it involve a so-called haircut, such as the PSI in 2011 and 2012?
Yeah, well, look, in the last PSI, the debt was reduced by $100 billion or something, right? And what happened to the economy? Like, it got worse. Why? Because what is the debt? The debt is Greek bonds. What are Greek bonds? Greek bonds are savings accounts in the European Central Bank system, at the Bank of Greece. And some person, some corporation, some entity, that's their money. They've got €1 million in the Bank of Greece earning interest in a savings account called a Greek bond. And when you take that away, when you reduce the debt by $100 billion, you've reduced the money supply, an important part of the money supply, the base money, what I call base money, by $100 million. It's like a tax. So you've taxed the economy €100 billion when they remove the €100 billion of Greek debt. So the answer is not right now to remove the money supply, to tax the economy. Taxing will make it worse. And debt reduction is a tax. It makes it worse. The Greek debt now is not any kind of a burden to Greece. It's maybe a psychological burden, but it's not an economic burden. First of all, the maturity is 20 years. Second of all, the interest rate's almost nothing. So there's no annual tax, so to speak, that's dedicated towards debt reduction right now. There is no such thing. Whatever debt service is there just gets refinanced and piled on to the end. So for all practical purposes, there is no debt burden for Greece right now. And that is not the problem. And debt reduction would only make it worse. What Greece actually needs is to have more debt. That's the answer. The answer is they need to reduce taxes and increase public spending, one of the two or some combination. You reduce taxes to increase private sector spending, you increase public sector spending to increase spending. But the problem in Greece is the Greeks are very, very good savers. They spend a lower portion of their income than other Europeans. Where does that come from? There has to be some entity that's allowed to spend more than its income to make up for the people spending less than their income. Okay, otherwise the output doesn't get sold. It comes back to the same thing. And so because they're good savers, they should be entitled to having a larger budget deficit. They should be able to have lower taxes and higher public spending because the private sector is not doing the spending. So let the public sector, you know, they're defaulting the spending to the public sector. And the irony is that the debt limits in the European Union are rewarding the bad savers and punishing the good savers. The 3% increase in debt allowed every year means that savings, net savings of Euro financial assets in the European Union are only allowed to grow at 3% a year. And any country that requires larger savings than that because of its institutional structure suffers the consequences of high unemployment. And the countries that have high private sector debt growth and therefore don't have high net savings desires, you know, they benefit. Now, what sense does that make? In the European Union, savings is a virtue. The public sector finances, they are just the accounting record of what's going on in the private sector. Okay, they account for what's happening in the private sector. When the public sector spends a euro and they say, okay, there's public sector spending of 1 euro, that means there's private sector income of 1 euro. So the public sector spending is the accounting record of the private sector income. When they say there's public sector debt of 100 billion euro, that means there's a private sector savings of 100 billion euro. The public sector debt is the accounting record. It's the number of euro in bank accounts at the ECB system of the private sector. And that's how accounting works. There's a debit on one side, credit on the other side of the ledger. The public sector is one side of the ledger. The private sector is the other side. It's a mirror image. It has to be. Or some accountant's made an arithmetic mistake and he's got to stay late and find his error. So yes, savings is a good thing. But the European Union is a union of people. It's a union of businesses. It's a union of private entities. The government is there to service the private sector and to support it. So savings is a good thing. That means we want to encourage private sector savings. There's too much private sector debt. We want private sector savings. And the accounting record, the evidence of private sector savings is public sector debt. And so if you look at the countries that had the highest private sector savings, it's always the countries that had the highest public sector debt. So it was Greece and Italy, which had the highest debt. Why? Because that's how you accounted for the high private savings. That's how you funded the savings. Loans create deposits. You know, debt funds savings. It's not the other way around.
This is the Alois Radio. We will return after a short break.
Αναθεμάσαι για άλλα, μπερδεύεις, ξεμπερδεύεις. ήσουν θεριό και μέρωσες, η δύναμη γυρεύεις. Βασταλά έγερα, μην πέφτεις χαμηλά. Οι αετοί πέτου στον ουρανό να βγουν. Φώναξε να'ρθουν οι καιροί, να'ρθουν ξανά τα χρόνια. Να ζωντανέψουν οι στιγμές, να λιώσουνε τα χιόνια. Βασταλά έγερα, μη πέφτεις χαμηλά. Οι αετοί πέτου στον ουρανό να βγουν. Ράγιο κάνε στη ζωή να φύγει καταιγίδα. Να ξαστεριάσει ένα πρωί, να'ρθει καινούρια ελπίδα. Βασταλά έγερα, μη πέφτεις χαμηλά. Οι αετοί πέτου τον ουρανό να βγουν. Φτεράκια νε σου σπάσανε, θα ξαναφτερουγήσεις. Θα ξαναβγείς στον ουρανό, τα χαμηλά να αφήσεις. Βασταλά έγερα, μη πέφτεις χαμηλά. Αετοί πέτου στον ουρανό να βγουν. Αντισταθείτε στους δρόμους, βγείτε Έλληνες, είμαστε του κεράτα. Κάτι να πούμε κι ας μη μιλούμε με νεύματα σιωπηλά. Βασταλά
We now return to the Diálogos interview series here on Diálogos Radio. We are on the air with economist Warren Mosler here on Diálogos Radio in the Diálogos interview series. And Warren, you have described modern economics as banana republic economics. What do you make of the economic policies that are currently being implemented across the European Union and of agreements such as the recent memorandum agreement between Greece and the so-called Troika?
Yeah, so what's happened is the third leg is we have to talk about is exports in the foreign sector. So the European Union has decided that export-led growth is the way to go. And they kind of looked at Germany as the example, as a model. And everybody's trying to do that to be more competitive. And all these programs are designed to reduce costs in Greece to make them more competitive so that they can export. Now, a couple of issues with that. And one of them is the macro issue where the whole world can't be exporters because everybody can't export. Somebody's got to import. You can't just, where's it going to go? To the moon or something? Wherever it goes is somebody importing. So at best, you know, all the trade in the world adds up to zero for every export there's an import. But apart from that, then there's another aspect before I get to the more serious problem, not that this is any less serious, and that is exports are real costs and imports are real benefits. The real wealth of any region is everything you produce domestically plus everything the rest of the world sends to you minus what you have to send to them. So it's your pile of stuff. Production makes your pile bigger, imports make your pile bigger, and exports make your pile smaller. You're sending that away. And in fact, if you look at war reparations, because when you win the war, the other country sends things to you. You don't send things to them. When Caesar conquered Gaul, Gaul sent grain to Rome. Rome didn't start sending grain to Gaul as war reparations. You pay imports are the real benefit, exports are real costs, and you use the monetary system to optimize that, and that used to be called real terms of trade. You try and get the most for the least. If you're going to export, the whole point is to get imports, and you try and get as many imports as possible for your exports. Okay, so the idea that export-led growth makes any sense, it's completely out of context with today's realities. That did make some sense under what was called mercantilism, where the game was to get as much gold as possible. Whoever had the most gold wins. And so the big exporters were getting the money, which was gold, and they were building gold stocks. And so whoever got the most gold won. Now, it was just an arbitrary game. And going into World War II, the United States had won the game. We had more gold than anybody else, except we didn't have any tanks or planes or guns, and it took us 4 years to mount a counterattack. So anyway, back to today's context, exports are real costs, imports are real benefits. So what's the whole point of European Union export or growth strategy? It doesn't make any sense at all. But all that aside, if you're going to do it, the way it's done is, and you can look at the old German export-led growth model, which was successful on its own terms. You use tight fiscal policy to suppress domestic demand, and you have all kinds of like structural reforms and deals with unions and labor to keep wages down, to keep competitiveness, and that helps your exports. Now suddenly you're competitive and you can export. But what that does is it makes your currency go up. And so what the exporters did, what Germany used to do, is they would buy dollars to keep the mark down, sell marks to buy dollars. They even bought lira to be able to export to Italy to keep the mark down versus the lira. And so part of the export-led growth strategy is you have to buy the other guy's currency, whether you like it or not, to keep your competitiveness. Otherwise, your currency appreciates and your policy is self-defeating. And that's happened a couple of times over the years in the European Union, where just as exports get going a little bit, the euro goes up and then they go down and you lose your advantages. Now, the problem in the European Union with this strategy is that buying dollars would, for example, is ideologically they can't do it, because then it would look like the ECB is building dollar reserves. Not look like it. They would be building dollar reserves. We give the appearance that the dollar is backing the euro, and they want the euro to be the reserve currency, not the dollar. And so they'd be supporting, you know, the dollar's role in the world, whatever that means. And so they just don't do it. They can't do it. And so instead, they just generally let the euro go up. Now, more recently, what the central bank's been doing, what Draghi's been doing, has been tricking the world's portfolio managers into selling euros by doing things that they think are inflationary, they think are expansionary, things that cause the currency to go down. And those are negative interest rates and quantitative easing. All the world's been Western educated now. They've all gone to the University of Chicago and Stanford and London School of Economics. And they all know that pumping up the money supply through quantitative easing and negative rates makes the currency go down and causes inflation. They're wrong, because it doesn't. You know, as I explained before, in fact, those policies remove interest income. They're taxes on the economy. They actually cause the currency to get stronger. They cause the price pressures to go lower. They cause deflationary pressures instead of inflationary pressures. We've seen the deflationary pressures on the euro right now, bordering on deflation. And the policies of quantitative easing and negative rates have done nothing to ease that. Now, why has the euro gone down? Because they've frightened portfolio managers around the world into selling their euro. So you've got even the Swiss National Bank buy Swiss francs with the euro. The Swiss National Bank takes the euro, and they've got 33% in dollars. They sold euro to buy dollars. I'm sure they're scared to death of holding the euro because of the quantitative easing and negative rates. Same with the Bank of China, Bank of Japan. They've got all these mainstream type, traditionally trained central bankers, just blind fear of holding euro right now. And so that's temporarily kept the euro from appreciating, which it would have otherwise done, because the lower euro now has driven trade into a massive surplus, right? I think the last number I saw was $31 billion trade surplus for the last month. The competitiveness is causing a trade surplus, which is sort of the point of the policy. But what that means is when Americans buy, you know, an Audi or a Volkswagen, not a diesel, but, you know, the other gas cars, they take their dollars, they give it to the dealer, gives them to Mercedes or to Volkswagen, and then they sell the dollars, buy euro, and meet their payroll and build their reserves, whatever they do with their money. And so what happens when you're running a trade surplus is the world is selling dollars to buy euro, to buy products, selling yen to buy euro, to buy products. And so it's continuous upward pressure on the euro, which in this case has been offset by massive portfolio selling. And you can look at the drops in central bank holdings from near 30% to under 20%. Reserves are, you know, in euro right now. And at some point that dries up. Now, an analogy would be if the corn crop failed because it didn't rain and it was a drought. Now, you would think the price would go up because of supply and demand. But if a big company like Cargill Grain or General Mills or somebody had a huge warehouse full of corn and had had it backwards and decided and believed that the drought was going to cause prices to go down instead of up. And they started selling their warehouse full of corn. Well, the price would go down, even though there was a drought and a shortage, because all the supply is coming out of the warehouse. That's portfolio selling, so to speak. Now, they're eventually going to run out, and there is a shortage. People are eating more than is being grown, and the price is going to go up at some point. But depending on the size of their warehouse, the price can go down for a long time. It can go down for a year, 2 years. I can't tell you the timing. But you can see the flows when you see the international accounts. You can see it's going down, and you can see the euro reserves are dropping all over the world in all these official type of accounts. And they can only drop so far, and then they're gone. And as they do drop, they're keeping the euro at levels that's supporting a growing trade surplus, which is draining the euros out as fast as they're selling them. And then they're gone, and then everybody's underweight euro or short, and there are no euro to buy back, and then it goes the other way.
The Greek government is intending to proceed with a recapitalization of the country's banks, with the threat of a bail-in if this does not take place. What would the impact of either option be for Greece and for its depositors?
Right. So bail-in is just a tax on depositors, right? So it's another tax that just removes more euro from the economy, reduces sales, and makes things worse. I don't think any of them understand the role of bank capital. I guess they're looking at it from a safety point of view. But you've got the European Union now regulating and supervising the banking system. So they're examining every loan for safety. And you've had years, tens of years, decades of public banks in Europe before the European Union that ran with no capital. Central banks can run with no capital. So the banking system doesn't need capital to operate. Capital is a political decision based on the amount of risk that the regulators decide they want to take on the bank's loan portfolio. But they're supervising and regulating that loan portfolio on a day-to-day basis. So it's kind of like their own loan portfolio. And so it's just as easy to control the risk on the regulatory side as it is on the capital side. And it doesn't seem to enter into the conversation at all. But I don't see any problem with requiring higher capital ratios if they want. And in an environment where banking is profitable, raising capital is not a problem for those ratios. But in the European Union, the problem is it's not a profitable environment for banking. Therefore, it's hard for banks, or nearly impossible, to raise capital. And so it's a self-defeating policy. If they were to relax the deficit limits from 3 to 8, for example, and the European Union was growing at 3%, banking would be profitable, and then there'd be no issue about raising capital. There'd be capital like waiting in line to get in. They'd have to be restricting bank licenses. So you create a weak economy with low aggregate demand, and then you wonder why you can't capitalize your banks. You know, they're speaking out of both sides of their mouth.
We are speaking with economist Warren Mosler here on the Alagos Radio and in the Alagos interview series. And Warren, you have presented a solution regarding how Greece could exit the Eurozone in an orderly fashion and without an explosive devaluation of its new currency. Tell us how this could take place.
Okay, so I wouldn't call it necessarily a solution, but it's an option. So the solution is larger deficits. If the European Union won't allow a larger deficit, if they force spending cuts, if they force taxes that cut spending more, then the option is one to just sit there and suffer and watch the civilization be destroyed, or two, to do it on your own, go back to your own currency. And if you're going to do it on your own currency, I have proposals out on how to do that in a way that actually I think works. But the first thing you do is you just start taxing and spending in the new currency, let's call it the new drachma. And when you do that, you're not leaving the euro. You're not doing anything. You're not abandoning anything. You're just changing your tax liability from euro to drachma, and you leave the number the same. If it was 100 euro, it's now 100 drachma. And then you start paying your public employees in drachma. And if it was 100 euro, you pay them 100 drachma. So you haven't left anything. You haven't broken any promises or abandoned any treaties or defaulted on any debt. You haven't converted any bank deposits. And specifically, I say don't convert any bank deposits. If the banks have euro deposits, leave them alone. If the debt's in euro, just leave it alone. And the easiest way to explain that is to make a assumption that it's just an arbitrary number now, that let's say half the people would want to hold the euro, but half the people would want the new drachma. Half the bank depositors would want to keep the euro and half would want drachma. And so if you convert everything to drachma, now you've got half the money supply, you know, half the funds in the banking system that are very unhappy. They wanted their euro. They don't want the drachma. So they will sell their drachma to buy euro. That will drive the currency down 30, 40, 50%, just like everyone predicts. And then you start getting inflation in terms of imported prices. And then the central bank doesn't know how to deal with it. So they raise rates and unemployment goes up and you're right back in this disaster, you know, that the Greeks have known so well, which is why they'd rather have high unemployment but let the Germans run the money than let their own local government run the money, right? Because they've seen what happened before when the local government ran the money. So that's what happens when you convert deposits. You get right back into that mess that politicians can technocrats just can't deal with it, and the government collapses and falls apart, and you've got blood in the streets again. If, on the other hand, you don't convert the deposits, you leave them in euro, now you've got half of those people, you know, the people who want a euro, they're okay, but the other half need drachma to run their businesses, run their lives, pay their kids' tuition, you know, pay their taxes, and they've got euro. So they need to sell their euro to buy drachma to run their lives, because there aren't any drachma out there. So they're selling euro to buy drachma. Now the drachma is a strong currency. You've created probably the biggest short squeeze in the history of the world, because everybody needs this stuff and there isn't any. And that allows the government to sell drachma at a slight premium to the euro, maybe 101 or something small, so that people can sell their euro, buy drachma at a reasonable price to run their lives. And that keeps the currency stable, and it gives the government a source of euro income to pay down and service their euro debt for some period of time. And it gives them a 6 month, 3 month, 6 months, a year breathing space to deal with the new economy and the new realities without having to deal with a currency that's collapsing. And it gives them a source of euro income to deal with it. Now, I'm not saying that there won't be other problems like corruption and whatnot, but at least you're working in the context of a firm currency and euro income to deal with your issues. And so the most important thing about conversion is, do not convert the bank deposits. Just leave them alone. And don't convert the public debt, which is just bank deposits in the central bank. Just leave it alone. And that will give you a smooth, or much, much smoother transition period towards running an independent nation. But here's the thing, though. Every proposal I've seen says convert all the bank deposits so you have control over them, whatever that means. And so every one of them, if they do go to drachma, any of the proposals I've seen are going to be a disaster.
Well, Warren, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us today here on the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos Interview Series, and for sharing your insights with our listeners.
Okay. Good. Thanks for having me on.
Attention iTunes users, the Dialogos Radio is now just a click away. You can now download our podcasts and listen to the Dialogos Radio 24/7 anytime, anywhere. Check us out today in the iTunes podcast directory and in iTunes Radio.
Γιατί με σένα μοιάζει.
Είναι ωραία η
θάλασσα γιατί κινείται πάντα. Κι αν έχεις βρει πολλές ταιριές, καμία δεν σ' αράζει. Δώσ' μου για φιλοδόρημα, τραγούδι με την πάντα. Είναι ωραία η θάλασσα γιατί με σένα μοιάζει.
Take the Dialogos Radio on the go with you with the new Dialogos Radio app for Android devices. Now you can listen live to the Dialogos Radio and the Dialogos Radio 24/7, download our podcasts, and read our latest articles all in our free Android app, available now in the Google Play Store. That was Pixlax here on the Dialogos Radio with Meli Dron, while earlier we heard Vasilis Koulas with the song Antistathite, or Rise Up. We just wrapped up this week's edition of the Dialogos interview series and our interview with economist Warren Mosler. The podcast of this interview, as with all of our interviews and commentaries, will soon be available on our website, dialogosmedia.org, where you can also find our on-demand programming, transcripts of our past interviews, our past playlists, our articles and written work, and where you can also listen to our online radio station, Dialogos Radio 24/7. Our podcasts are also available in the Dialogos Radio apps for Android, Kindle, BlackBerry, and Chrome, in iTunes, TuneIn.com, and the Windows Store, and in the Nobex Radio, WeCast, Player FM, and Stitcher apps. Coming up next here on Dialogos Radio is our commentary of the week. Dialogos Radio's Commentary of the Week. Each week, Michael Navratakis provides views and opinions on issues pertaining to Greece and to the worldwide Greek community. Coming up next, here on Dialogos Radio. Another year, another commemoration. Thousands of people marched on the streets of Athens on November 17th for the 42nd consecutive year, commemorating the anniversary of the so-called Polytechnic Uprising in Athens, a deadly incident where dozens of Greeks who were protesting against the rule of the country's U.S.-backed military dictatorship were killed on that day. This march, which runs from the Polytechnic campus to the U.S. Embassy in Athens, has become an annual event. And yet, what is truly being commemorated? The people who were killed on that day? There have been people murdered by governments, militaries, and police forces all throughout history and even to the present day that unfortunately nobody acknowledges. Perhaps then we are commemorating the fall of the military junta, but this ignores the reality that many of the leaders of this uprising became part of Greece's next generation of corrupt kleptocrat politicians and government ministers who helped lead Greece into its current abyss. The reality is that when a military government fell, Greece's government simply changed hands to another type of dictatorship, one which has today blossomed into a full-fledged dictatorship of the European Union, the Eurozone, the International Monetary Fund, as well as foreign and Greek bankers. Hardly a cause for commemoration. What really made this year's commemoration ludicrous, though, was the sight of Syriza's block of protesters being essentially escorted along the protest route by the riot police, who were in fact protecting them. The same riot police which have broken up essentially every peaceful protest in Greece over the past several years, firing tear gas and physically beating and injuring peaceful protesters, innocent bystanders, and journalists. The same riot police who Syriza, prior to the January elections, had promised to break up and disband. The same riot police that I personally, with my own eyes, witnessed mingling with plainclothes hooded provocateurs in a back street behind the U.S. Embassy in Athens a few years ago. These same riot police were protecting Syriza's participants at the November 17th commemoration march. Does anyone else see what is wrong with this picture? Syriza may not be disbanding the riot police, which are now protecting its supporters anytime soon, but no similar protections are being afforded to tens of thousands of suffering homeowners in Greece, whose properties are now at risk of being foreclosed
closed upon after the latest quote-unquote deal with the Troika. According to the allegedly leftist Greek finance minister Euclid Tsakalotos, the government agreed to, quote, whatever was required by the lenders in order to receive the next tranche of so-called bailout funds totaling 2 billion euros. All this from the same government that promised to protect the Greek people against foreclosures, promised to repeal the unconstitutional and illegal unified property tax, and promised to tear up the memorandum agreements and to repeal them with one law and one article. Compare and contrast this to the country B of our previous commentary, Iceland, whose parliament last Friday passed the bill into law which essentially writes off the mortgages of more than half of its population as the country continues its recovery from its own financial collapse. This bill was passed despite the strong objections of the International Monetary Fund, the OECD, and ratings agency Standard & Poor's. So while Iceland is standing up to this international cartel of economic hitmen in Armani suits, Greece's oh-so-leftist government has yet again said yes, yes, yes to everything that the IMF, the European Union, and the rest of this gang of banksters and criminals has demanded from Greece. There is good news, however, for those households who will be thrown out onto the streets after the newly permitted foreclosures become reality in Greece. Syriza's member of parliament Eleni Stamatakis has a modest proposal. Citizens can drop off their leftover food next to trash bins for the poor to collect and to eat. This is what is being said by an elected member of parliament of a supposedly radical and left-wing government in Greece. Nothing about actually alleviating poverty or providing electricity and food to the impoverished, which is what Syriza had been claiming it would do prior to its initial election. No, leave your leftover or rotten food next to trash bins for the poor to eat. Even a year ago, we were warning about Syriza on our commentaries right here on the Allegos Radio and got absolutely bashed and trashed, pun intended, by the Hope and Change crowd who refused to harbor any criticism of the great new hope named Syriza and Alexis Tsipras. What do you all have to say for yourselves now? Oh, but I forgot. None of these horrible things will happen because the Syriza government is implementing its agreement with the Troika and its EU so-called partners to the letter, and in return, Greece is being, quote, bailed out with European money. The same European disunion, union, which apparently misspent 6.3 billion euros of its funds in 2014, according to the European Court of Auditors, indeed failing this audit for the 21st consecutive year. So while it's okay when the European Union breaks the rules, the European Union has the audacity to lecture other countries about their supposed economic misdeeds and for purportedly living beyond their means. Never fear, though, Yanis Varoufakis is here, and he will save the day with his supposed pan-European anti-austerity movement. The same Yanis Varoufakis, whom I can confirm, was given personally the same proposed solutions for Greece's economic crisis, including the option to return to the drachma, that we heard in today's interview with economist Warren Mosler. The same Yanis Varoufakis who has said that there is no alternative option, no plan B, no solution other than a so-called European solution. And the same oh-so-leftist Yanis Varoufakis, who in an interview with The Observer this past September stated that when he was in charge of the negotiations as Greece's finance minister, he proposed standard Thatcherite and Reagan-esque economic policies, including privatizations. The same Varoufakis who in a recent talk at the People's Assembly in London praised Thatcherism for its, quote, dynamic and radical individualism. The same Varoufakis who as finance minister brought in former Thatcherite Minister of State for Trade and Industry Norman Lamont as a, quote, consultant. Therefore, it is no wonder that Varoufakis, just like his former party, which is still in power in Greece, Syriza, just so happens to say the same thing as Thatcher. There is no alternative. No alternative to Europe, no alternative to the euro, no alternative to foreclosures and privatizations and a vicious, out-of-control riot police tear gassing people, no alternative to debilitating austerity, no alternative to the European dream, which continues to be nothing short of a nightmare. TheAllegosMedia.org, our website which brings you the latest news from the Allegos Radio, live streaming of the Allegos Radio 24/7, podcasts, on-demand programming, and much more. Visit us today at TheAllegosMedia.org. Thank you.
μπήκαν οι εχθροί μα δεν τους είδες. Δεν είχαν δόρατα κι ασπίδες. Μοιράζουν κάλπικες ελπίδες και αγοράζουνε πατρίδες. Δεν έχουν βόλια και μυδράλια, ελέγχουν τύπο και κανάλια. Δεν ρίχνουν βόμβες πια στους κήπους, μα στο μυαλό μας ρίχνουν ρήπους. Μπήκαν οι εχθροί μα δεν τους είδες. Δεν είχαν δόρατα κι καθαρίζουμε μονάχοι, γιατί σαν είμαστε ενωμένοι ποτέ δεν βγαίνουμε ηττημένοι. Στείλετε μου αν μ' ακούς κι άλλους εχθρούς πιο δυνατούς. Γιατί σαν λείψουν οι εχθροί μας, θα φαγωθούμε μεταξύ μας. Μπήκαν οι εχθροί μα δεν τους είδες. Δεν είχαν δόρατα κι ασπίδες. Μα δεν τους είδες, δεν είχαν δόρατα, δεν είχαν δόρατα κι ασπίδες.
Follow Diálogos Radio on Facebook and Twitter and remain connected to all our latest news and updates. Check us out today at facebook.com/dialogosmedia and at twitter.com/dialogosmedia.
We just heard some new music here on Diálogos Radio that is relevant to our times, a song by Nikos Trifilis titled Bikani Ekthri, or The Enemies Have Arrived. This is Diálogos Radio, where today's program is just about ready to come to a close. We will be back on the air in a couple of weeks from today with the Diálogos Radio Christmas special and a holiday-themed program with a special guest that will soon be announced. Keep checking our website, dialogosmedia.org, for more details about what's coming up, and our website is also where you can find our recently published interviews with Panayotis Economidis of Greece's No Middleman Movement, which was recently featured in 99getsmart.com, and with aviation expert Bill Kalivas, which was recently published by GreekTV.com. We will wrap up today's broadcast with one final song, with Marinella singing Treli. Thank you for joining us once again this week here on Diálogos Radio, and have a wonderful weekend.
Εγώ πέ... παιδί μου είμαι τρελή και λουζομαι με στη βροχή. Όταν οι άλλοι πνιγόνται σε μια ψυχαλά, εγώ παιδί μου είμαι τρελή, γι' αυτό με πάει το φίλι. Κι που σε πάνε τα τραγούδια τα μεγάλα, κι όταν έρχεται το βράδυ, τότε απλώνω στο σκοτάδι τη φωνή μου και το κλάμα ως τους ουρανούς. Κι όσοι ξέρουν αγαπάνε έρχονται.